Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Having another walk through the Welsh Hills today. It's very, very hot. We could do with some rain actually. The hills are looking a bit parched. Anyway, we thought we'd crack on with the Lao Tzu. Do another chapter of that today. So today we're going to do episode 20. And we're going to be reading out chapter 33. Then we'll have a little bit of a chat about that and see what we think that Lao Tzu was thinking that day.
When you know the true being of another, you can judge. If you truly know the Tao, you will be in the light. It takes force to control people, but if I am humble, I can never be overcome. If you know what you have is enough, you will be satisfied. But if you think you don't have enough, then you will never have enough. If you follow the Tao, what you are will last. You will live and live and outlive yourself again.
Okay, so shall we start with the first few lines? So when you know the true being of another, you can judge. And if you truly know the Tao, you will be in the light. So what mood was Lao Tzu in that day, you think?
Well, who knows? And it's quite interesting that you said at the outset, we'll try and figure out what Lao Tzu was thinking that day. And of course, you've just said, what mood was he in that day?
Because I think one thing we should remember that Lao Tzu could have been a collection of people,
yeah,
and possibly not written at the same time exactly,
yeah,
either.
Yeah.
And they were all people,
yeah,
and they all did have,
yeah,
their own moods and events, their
yeah,
own life events,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
could have been, you know, that were influencing their sort of thoughts and what they were,
yeah,
writing,
yeah,
on,
I mean,
those particular days.
It's a legitimate question, and it's a legitimate way of approaching a text, is to try and figure out where it came from. And that means something about the author or authors. And obviously contextualising in the period of the Warring States and in the context of Lao Tzu's life as a somebody who'd had enough and was about to drop out and pass through the Western Gate into the hills. A sentiment that we understand.
Yeah, so it is said.
And all of that's completely legitimate, but there is another approach to text, which philosophers have concerned themselves with in the 20th century, so the second half of the 20th century. And there's an approach called textualism. And there are a couple of varieties, at least, of textualism. You know, weak textualism and strong textualism. And I think we have talked about this before in podcasts. I'm sure I've mentioned it a few times, even though it all sort of blurs into one in my mind, you know. But this is the idea that a text is there for you to use, and you can unashamedly use it. I think it's incumbent upon you to say that that's what you're doing, you know, rather than trying to find the truth of the text. I mean, actually, you start thinking about what is the truth of a text, and you go into a labyrinth and you wander around for a few lifetimes. And if you're lucky, you find a way out, and you think, well, I'm still none the wiser. It's kind of trickier than you think, the truth of a text.
Mm.
Is it the author's ego? Does it come out of the unconscious of the author? Is it nothing to do with the author ultimately, especially when it's so remote in time, thousands and thousands of years ago? Is it perhaps just an expression of the time? Is it society speaking through? Or some aspect of society? Some accidental event in which an author becomes simply the vehicle for discourse, for the thread of ideas and gossip, and should we read it as a symptom? You know, so you get all these problems, and the textualists were people that would say, well, I'm just going to, this is interesting to me, I'm going to use it. And a strong textualist will say, well, I'm just going to use it. I'm going to let it stimulate me and use it. I don't have the slightest worry about what the author intended. This author has been dead 2,500 years. How will we know? Now, I know we have taken that approach. And I do think certain features of the legend of Lao Tzu do enable us to... They give us textual tools, actually, for using the Lao Tzu very, very... very fruitfully. You know, the idea of the Western Gate, this is somebody tired of the world dropping out, who's going to live the life of contemplation for his last few years. And there is something existentially universal or archetypal about that, you know, and we could kind of use it. And also, you know, the notion of the warring states and the notion that's very clear in the Lao Tzu of this necessity of melding politics and spirituality, or meditation is a better word there. So I'm going to go a bit strong textual on this bit. This bit is saying to me, strong textualism. Even though, I mean, you know, when it suits us, we do contextualise and situate. So when you know the true being of another, you can judge. And if you truly know the Tao, you will be in the light. Now this is, well, it's about judgment, right? You can see the transparent surface meaning of that first stanza is to say that, well, perhaps we could kind of put it on its head. We can say, well, don't judge anybody unless you really know them, unless you know their being. Then you can judge. But until you know their being, you can't judge. You're just projecting your prejudices or making shit up or just being a twat, you know. So he's saying, well, you can judge, but this is the way to do it, is to know the being of another. And we've mentioned in the light of the previous chapters of the Lao Tzu that we've interpreted, that Lao Tzu thinks that if you have a certain quietness in your being, that the nature of things reveals itself to you. And I think that applies too with people. If you have a certain quietness, a contemplative quietness in your being, and you encounter another, you'll have some insight into their being. Now, this is a very real feeling. We might think that it goes too far in the modern era. It's a bit too woo-woo, you know. And we all know annoying people who think they know us because they're getting the vibe or whatever, or they've got some gypsy powers or whatever the fuck it is. And it is a little something that you ought to be a bit careful with, I would say. Even though I think there is a real observation there that this ancient way of knowing, which is to encounter a person, an object, an animal, an event, a situation, with a certain sensitivity, openness, quietness of being, that's... You do find yourself in possession of information.
So in that kind of state, you could know someone very quickly, in fact.
Yeah, well, if it's true.
But straight away.
It certainly feels like it. It certainly feels like it. And it's also that the actions that are based on that kind of thing, if it's done properly, are seldom destructive, and often they do bear out your insight or your hunch or whatever you might call it, you know. Your intuition. And you can know through experience, long experience, quite how good your intuition is or how bad it is or whatever. So this is about that, you know. And he's not saying, you know, never judge anybody. And we've got a kind of a bit of a thing.
Because, of course, that, you know, the ability to do that in a way which helps you to make good decisions in life is essential.
Yeah. I mean, we do in our current culture have amongst certain sections of society, you know, an aversion to passing judgment on anything. That's your opinion, man. You know what I mean? I don't know. And being judgmental is thought to be a horrible trait. And, of course, it can be, especially when the judgments made don't have any bearing on the reality. So if you're judging somebody's character and it's just not true, you know, it just has no bearing on what they're like. And how you would find them if you, say, lived with them. So there's a bit of sense in the anti-judgmentalism of, you know, certain aspects of modern culture. But at the same time, human life is dependent on judgment. You know, whether something's beautiful, whether something's sublime, whether something's harmful, whether something is a good and useful, or all these kind of things. They are basically judgments. And judgment is about ascertaining types of value of objects, people, animals, things, events, situations, and so forth. And it's just, it's such a part of human life. The human form of life would pretty well be impossible without our ability to do it. So Lao Tzu saying, well, here's the best way to do it. I mean, he's a great meditator, and he finds that it delivers goods. I don't think we should believe it until we've proved it by practicing it and checking and quietly, revisiting our assessments or judgments. Yeah. and checking them. So, was that a good judgment? Was that a bad judgment? Is my intuition working, or is it faulty? And so forth. You shouldn't rush to just thinking that in some kind of magical way you can become a good judge of character just by looking somebody in the eye. You can't. So I think that's what he's getting at there. And then what's the next thing that he says? Something about the, if you truly know the Tao, you will be in the light. Well, truly knowing the Tao is being accomplished, even though that's the wrong word, it's the best one I can find, in the kind of meditation that we're talking about, where one simply encounters experience, existence, people, things, objects, processes, etc., with an openness, a sensitivity, and a quietness. If you become sufficiently immersed in that mode of being, that is what he calls, you know, being with the Tao, or knowing the Tao, or then you will be in the light. Well, that means that things will be illuminated. You're in the light, things are illuminated. You're in the light, so people you encounter are illuminated. You are able to see their true character because you're in the light, because you're meditative. But as I say, it's not something to just pick up and think, here is this automatic, I know everything scenario. This is one of the dangers with this stuff, I suppose. So you don't become too woo-woo about it, you know. It's actually really something very gritty and down-to-earth. It goes on then, it takes force to control people. But if I am humble, I could never be overcome. Well, yes, sure. We've remarked on numerous occasions when doing these podcasts about the Lao Tzu that he's a right peacenik, you know. And he also thinks force is counterproductive. And we're witnessing this at the moment, you know. America is on fire as the institutional racism, particularly of some of the police forces in the U.S.
As the president.
Oh, and the president, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the deep roots in racism of American society are coming home to roost. And, of course, we see a militarised police force kitted out like robo-cops wading in, bashing people about, and of course they overcome with force. They're not going to put the lid back on this, I don't think. They might quieten the streets for a while. Nobody wants their head bashed in. Eventually they'll go home, you know, and hide away and figure out their next moves, the people who are being bashed up. But that's the kind of thing he's talking about, you know, just brute force you can overcome. But, I mean, he's got this Tai Chi thing, you know, brute force. That's not the most intelligent way to proceed when there is conflict. By being humble or underneath everything, or not succumbing to anger or the egotistical need to win. But then you can't be overcome. And it's a plea for non-violence. Of a very subtle and refined and exact kind. And I would say he's right. You know, when this lesson is learned by the peoples of the world. I was going to say, of, you know, who are the citizens in oppressive societies, which is everybody. When they learn this lesson, they'll be unstoppable. If you know what you have is enough, you will be satisfied. Well, again, this is a familiar theme with him, is that he's anti-consumerist, isn't he?
Yeah.
We have a society in which desire is inflamed, in which there's a $1 trillion industry whose sole aim is to inflame desire so that we'll buy the shit, much of which is useless, and the production of which is polluting and destructive. But we'll want it, we'll want it, we'll want it, and we'll buy it, and it keeps the whole thing ticking over. You know, the world economy is driven now by, at least the rich half of it, is driven by artificially inflamed desire. You know, so Lao Tzu sees it as a kind of slavery, I think, as a kind of affliction. Well, there's no need for it. You can have enough, and it's great. You can be satisfied with enough. You know, and a bit of relish, you know, the city of pigs. What, no relish? Oh, yeah, we'll have some relish. We'll have some nice jam or some pickle or something. There's no reason for life to be, like, absolutely grindingly brutal and frugal to the point of emaciation. But that isn't what makes a good, pleasing, joyous life, you know. Having enough is certainly a good part of that recipe. The good life does mean some security. That means food security.
Yeah.
Being able to stay out the weather. Some education for your kids. But you don't have to be a billionaire. You don't have to have 4 yachts. You know. In fact, past a certain point, I'm sure the misery then starts to go into grotesque realms in some ways. If you think you don't have enough, you'll never have enough. Well, again, this is the whole story about desire that we've got in Plato's Republic. And I don't know, you can actually think politics and think the good life and think ethics without having a very good exploration of desire. And Lao Tzu, again, is of the view that if desire is inflamed, it's insatiable. It's kind of miserable. I mean, there's nothing wrong with desire per se, you know. But we should also value being sated. Value the feeling when you were hungry, you ate something, and then you feel good for an hour or two in that respect, you know. We should value that too. And perhaps have some insight into the destructive nature of a culture that just inflames desire in order to keep its kind of hyperactive, destructive, malignant, cancerous economy going. Here's a guy who saw straight into that by doing what you have to do when you meditate and when you philosophise, particularly about politics, but also about personal life, is explore and seek to understand desire. We don't have to write it off or get sniffy and puritanical about it. You can't. Life is desire. At the same time, when it runs rampant, it's cancer. Okay, what we got? If you follow the Tao, what you are will last. You will live and live and live and outlive yourself again. Now, the Taoists were kind of interested in living a long, happy life. You know, longevity is a concern. And the other wing of Taoism, the more alchemical, tantric style of Taoism, which is a bit more interventionist in the human psychophysical complex than Lao Tzu's let it be type of Taoism, is very, very concerned about longevity, and they tried to make the elixir of immortality. And one of the famous emperors killed himself because he thought he'd made this elixir of immortality, and it was actually a compound of mercury. So they did actual physical alchemy. And he was taking this stuff, and of course it eventually killed him, being a central nervous system toxin. But there was an immense amount of energy and thought and obsession devoted to living a long life, including the various, you know, gymnosophist exercises, Daiji, parkour, all the qigong. It's devoted to the idea of living a long life. I mean, these are not ideas exclusive to China. You find it in the Indian alchemical systems and tantric systems, but also in Europe. European alchemy had similar concerns. There was a search for the elixir of immortality on the philosopher's stone and so forth. But even Lao Tzu, a contemplative Taoist, is much more into acceptance rather than non-doing rather than doing. I think he has a more profound understanding of life than the alchemical systems can yield for people, to be honest with you. But even here, he just says, well, a good long life, you know. A good long life. If you follow the Tao, what you are will last. You will live and live and live. I mean, so Lao Tzu's recipe for long life is following the Tao. In other words, doing that meditation of allowing yourself to be open to the stream of things, the flux of existence, and sensitive to it, and registering in greater and greater detail and sensitivity, simply by relaxing into it, by not interfering, by not overdoing. We don't need to be engaged in alchemical processes, whether physical or internal. For him, you just follow the Tao, and because the Tao is the flux and the flow of everything, and the deep being of that flowing reality. So we attune ourselves with that, and it's a meditation. And I think it's right, you know, you will, as a side effect, in many circumstances, not as a foolproof panacea, but in many circumstances, enjoy good health. And you probably would, if you could do that all your life, if they'd let you, you'd live a good long time. I'm going to read it again now, just to round it off. I think it's quite nice to have it fresh and then have it in the light of our attempts at deriving some wisdom from it. When you know the true being of another, you can judge. And if you truly know the Tao, you will be in the light. It takes force to control people, but if I am humble, I can never be overcome. If you know what you have is enough, you will be satisfied. But if you think you don't have enough, then you will never have enough. If you follow the Tao, what you are will last. You will live and live and outlive yourself again.
Anyway, I hope everyone found that interesting, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Make knowledge great again.